Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, 3D printing, and more. Whatever we can think about this week. How are you, Craig?
I'm good. I've literally just got back from a little trip. We've been away, so all in a bit of a blur at the moment. But yeah, I'm good. Can't complain. Yourself?
Yeah, going good. Been very productive.
Okay, well, we get into that in a second. I think firstly we should maybe mention why we didn't have a show last week.
Oh yes, good idea.
Oh, the fact that we did have a show, but it's now known as the Lost Show. It was all my fault. So we had a technical issue where basically all my audio equipment just stopped, just completely stopped. So we actually had an interview. So we were interviewing Bree Pettis from Bantam Tools, who make this really cool desktop CNC. And previously he was with MakerBot, and he founded MakerBot and Thingiverse and MakerMag, all these different things. Like, really fascinating guy. 5 minutes in and my audio crapped out, so we resorted to Aaron sort of handling the interview, and whenever I could sort of chip in, I was using the chat, and it didn't work so well, simply because every now and again my audio would come back in, so we thought, okay, let's carry on. So it was very sort of stuttered. But Aaron did a great job, so we've got those recordings anyway. So the plan is to get Bree back on the show, and we'll continue where we left off, and I can edit that all as one big show, and we should be good to go.
Yes, hopefully a bit smoother next time.
Yes, yeah. At one point, I was typing questions on my phone and holding that up to my webcam so they could see, because I wasn't sure if they could even see my chat.
We didn't see that. We could see your chat. We never saw the webcam thing, though.
Really? Oh, right. Oh, jeez. Yeah, it was. It wasn't the best of times. Let's say that.
In Canada, we
so
call
you
that
say
a
you've
shit
been
show.
Busy. You've been productive.
Yeah,
it was very a productive. Bit of a shit show.
Yeah, I've just been like trying to get into a rhythm for 2021. Trying to actually stick to like a production schedule this year. So, you know, day one of week one, I do this. Day two of week one, I do that, you know. And it's going well so far.
How long is your cycle? So, like, from a batch, like, day one, to how many days would it take to finish that batch before you return back to day one again?
I'm aiming for a month at the moment. Like, the biggest roadblock is DLC, because I have to send at least 30 knives to DLC each time. Yeah. And it takes, like, you know, a week to 2 weeks to get the blades back. So that's kind of my cycle limiter, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, overall, it's been going good. So fingers crossed. I just sent off a batch of blades
good
to
stuff.
DLC. And yeah, it's going good. How about
stuff.
You, mate?
I'm sort of the opposite. I still haven't got that get up and go of the new year yet. I'm still eking out the very last of the sort of holiday season. The way it works is my birthday is sort of, you know, it was just a few days ago, so sort of mid-January. And we always tend to do something like go away or something like that anyway. So it's always a slow ramp up for me. And I've got to the point where I've eaten everything in sight. I've drunk everything in sight. There's nothing left in the house. So I now just need to get back into work, basically. I've got no more distractions. So come tomorrow morning, it's back in sort of full time, like 9 to 6, and doing what I do. Yeah, so it's going to be a bit of a change, because I've had basically 3-4 weeks of being a lazy bastard, to be honest with you. So, yeah, I am actually looking forward to it.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Any news that we've missed out on in the last couple of weeks? Because, yeah, we didn't have that show last week, so we must have some stuff. What have you seen?
I've been keeping my eyes open, but nothing too crazy, honestly. Yeah, I don't know. I've been learning more about 3D printing, high-end 3D printing materials, which has been fun.
Ah, which brings me on to my bit of news, actually, the 3D printing stuff. Mm. There was a guy on TikTok. I don't know him. He's an American guy, but apparently he's a famous athlete. I'm trying to find his name here. Jimmy Choi, who's apparently an elite athlete. But he has Parkinson's, and he just uploaded a TikTok video, and he was trying to open a pill bottle. And he obviously found it really difficult, and he had these shaky hands, and he was finding it really difficult. So somebody who saw it on TikTok was into 3D printing. They contacted him and said, look, I could make something for you that would help. And he was like, oh, really? That'd be great. So he 3D printed this little tool to help open a pill box, which this Jimmy Choi then made a TikTok video about. A whole sort of community got together on TikTok. Anybody who had a 3D printer, they were like, these are great. Let's all just print these. And anybody who has Parkinson's and who's having this difficulty with these pill boxes, which apparently is a big, big problem, they were sending them out for like a small donation, which then went to the Michael J. Fox charity. Yeah, there was this whole sort of 3D printing army printing these bottle tops, these pill bottle tops. For people with Parkinson's, and they've now all the sort of IP for the design and so on, they've handed all of that over to the I said Michael Parkinson earlier, didn't I?
No, you said Michael J. Fox.
Oh, right, Michael J. Yeah. Fox, yeah, sorry, I'm getting mixed up. So all the IP, the design IP of these things are going to the Michael J. Fox Foundation as well. Nice. So, you know, they're really helping these people who had a problem, which for most people sort of went unnoticed. You wouldn't really notice, but it just shows how, you know, 3D printing, you can prototype quickly, and, you know, a whole community help people out, which I think is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about the last little while is, like, you know, I'm doing more prototype work in my shop now, trying to work out, like, what way of making things gives me the most agility. Like, I want to be able to, like, you know, have an idea one day for a part, or, you know, be working on a larger machine, design a part, and then the next day the part's done, you know, hopefully with minimal interference, you know, minimal work from me, as little as possible. And, you know, obviously I have the big CNC mills, but, like, CNC milling everything is probably not the right way to go. You know, like, not everything needs to be aluminum. I don't want to have to make soft jaws for every little thing, you know. So so I've been looking into 3D printing. Well, obviously, like, I've already got a 3D printer, but, like, the material that we use most often, PLA, is just not great for, like, industrial use.
And I've got a good example of that, actually. So we've just come away from a little sort of skiing trip here in France, and I printed off I wanted, like, a GoPro holder that I could stick on my ski pole.
Right.
So I managed to find it on Thingiverse rather than design one myself, printed it out in PLA, and it looked fantastic. It was like, well, this is going to do the job. Two runs down ski slopes, and you soon found the weakness in PLA. It was just splitting and cracking really. It's just really brittle, really, isn't it?
Yeah, what kind of infill did you print that with?
Like, I think it was 30% infill.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, PLA is definitely brittle. And I mean, in industrial applications, like what I'm thinking about, it also, the biggest issues are actually, like, it gets soft with high temperatures. And when I say high temperatures, I mean, like, 60 degrees, which is actually not all that high. And then the other issues is that it creeps. So if you put, like, a bolt through it and you bolt a piece down, under that constant pressure, the plastic will really slowly flow. So, like, 2 months from now, the part will have gotten squished by the bolt, and the clamping pressure won't be there anymore, you know. So it's been interesting. Like, there are a couple of options. Like, I know that you use your Prusa Mini and the Prusament and everything. So they have PETG and ASA as options.
Yeah.
Both of which would be, like, PETG for your GoPro mount would have been perfect.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yes. I just used what I had at hand here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then ASA is supposed to be really good too. I haven't tried ASA yet, but that's kind of on my list, my next thing. But I've been printing carbon fiber reinforced nylon.
Oh.
Yeah, and this stuff is
exotic
kind of at
sounding.
Level. Yeah. Yeah, and I had to modify my printer to be able to print it. Like, I needed an all-metal hot end.
Hmm.
And the other thing is, so I bought it a while ago, and it's just been sitting here, because I tried printing just plain nylon, and that was a shit show. And it still is a shit show. Like, it's really sensitive to moisture. Like, really sensitive to moisture. Right. So I've been drying my nylon for about 16 hours in the oven at this point at 90
wow.
degrees Celsius, and it's still not printing right because it's still got too much moisture in it.
How are you storing your filaments?
I have plastic boxes that I have desiccant in.
Right.
So they're like airtight.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I use an old brewing. I still do occasionally make beer. And so I've got a temperature controlled brewing fridge. So it works quite well, actually. So I hold my filament in there, which is around about 28 degrees I keep it at. But I also store my wood in there that I use for knife handles, too.
Oh, okay.
So everything sort of remains at a sort of constant temperature. Gotcha. With regards to moisture levels, I probably should be checking that as well. But my thinking is if it's the temperature isn't changing, it's always that same temperature. So it should be good, I think.
Well, the thing that I thought was really interesting was that, you know, I assumed that carbon fiber nylon would be, you know, worse than regular nylon. But it turns out it's not the case at all. Like, I printed with my carbon fiber nylon straight out of the box, undried. So it was about 35% humidity, I think. And it printed fine. I accidentally printed with the fan on, and the layers still stuck properly.
Oh, wow.
And, like, none of that shit would fly with unreinforced nylon, so...
And is that with a regular nozzle, like a 0.2 nozzle as well, or something
different? No. Well, you can go as small as 0.4 with CF nylon. Like, because you've got the fibers in there, you can't really go much smaller. But I'm printing with a 0.6 millimeter nozzle. Like, for my parts, there's not much point having a really small nozzle.
Yeah, I've got some wood filament here, and that's the same. You need to use a larger nozzle. Simply because all the little bits, you know, they'll just clog it up. It's one of those things.
Right.
But I can see you've been looking at metal 3D printing too.
Yes. Yeah, so we talked a couple of weeks ago about BASF, the chemical company, had introduced a metal filament that you could print in any printer, and then you'd send it away and they would debinder it and sinter it. Mm. And I've been really interested in, like, is there an option where you can debinder and sinter it at home. And I just remembered this company that I'd seen a while ago called The Virtual Foundry. So their website's thevirtualfoundry.com. And they sell materials that you can debinder and sinter at home. And so, like, a kilogram of... I think it's a kilogram. Maybe it's 500 grams of 316 stainless steel is, like, $70 US. And then you can fully process it at home if you have, like, a little... heat treat oven.
And that's what I've been looking at. So they've got like brass and bronze as well. They've got all these different materials. So what they're calling sintering, and hopefully you can explain to me what that is, that the debinding and the sintering. It looks as if they're using a knife making kiln. It looks like it's one of the standard sort of paragon knife making kilns. So I'm wondering what sort of temperature they're going to. But what is the debinding process before that?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So basically what they do is you put it in like a little container, so a crucible basically, like a, you know, literally just a little box or a cylinder, like a cup that can withstand high temperatures. And then you fill the crucible with what they call a refractory ballast. So it's basically like you're packing a powder around your 3D print to kind of hold it in place as the temperature goes up. If that
Got
makes
you,
sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I have to look at the website to see what the debindering temperature is. But basically, you heat it to like 600 degrees Celsius with that refractory ballast, and that the oxygen kind of gets in and burns off the plastic, So the filament is like 90% metal by volume, and then like 10% plastic. And so you basically burn off the plastic, which is the debindering step. And then you put a little bit of like carbon granules over the top of the refractory ballast to keep the air out. And then you heat it up to like, I think what it says, like 1300 Celsius in your little kiln. And you leave it there for like 50 minutes, and the little metal particles all kind of weld together. They sinter. And then you get like a metal part out at the end.
Yeah, so it's stuck in what is, I suppose, almost like a die, is it? The powder that you put around it, it'll keep everything in place and in its shape.
Yeah, and it's basically aluminum oxide powder. So it's like sandblasting powder, basically.
Yeah.
So there's like nothing fancy about that process.
I could imagine the nozzles on there would take some sort of, you'd need a hardened nozzle, I assume, just because of the abrasiveness of printing with that much metal material, I'd have thought.
Yeah, but if you're set up for printing like carbon fiber nylon or whatever, then you're already set up for printing the metal filaments.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
So it looks as if it's very possible to do at home then.
Yes. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to do it for everything, obviously. But like, you know, if you're trying to make a little turbine or something, like something that would be really complicated to machine, then it sounds like it might be a decent option. I don't know how good the dimensional accuracy of it is, because the parts do shrink quite a bit during the debindering and sintering process. So I'm sure there must be some distortion. But like, so cool that you can do that at home.
Yeah, yeah, you know, a proper usable solid part. That's pretty cool. So I put a shout out on Instagram for questions. We've had quite a few questions coming in, some specifically for Aaron, because as most people know, I'm the monkey on the show here. I'm the one who's trying to get as much out of Aaron as I possibly can. But let's take the first one. This was from Jab_knives, and they're on Instagram. Says, good day, sir. I'm a knife maker from South Africa, and I make liner lock folding knives on your upright machining and EDM episode. You mentioned laser versus water jet. He says, my question is, if laser cutting grade 5 titanium liners would be viable, as I've heard people saying it hardens the titanium, making it hard to drill holes. And he said, water jet is the other option, but as you mentioned, it may produce a tapered cut. So he's wondering if laser would basically cut through grade 5 titanium without hardening it.
Well, I don't think I've got anything here but good news for
Chad Knives. Congratulations!
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, so like number one, in like liner thicknesses, you're really not going to have to worry about taper from a water jet. So water jet would be totally fine. Thin thicknesses, you don't really have to worry too much about the taper. And then number two, the laser's only going to harden the titanium at the edges. So if you're worried about having to drill, as long as you're drilling away from the edges, so they call that the heat affected zone. There's like a zone near the cut that is hardened by the laser. So as long as you're drilling away from that, you should be totally fine. I think either way would be fine, personally.
Cool. And linked onto that, actually, we have a question from Scott Einsman as well. And he's talking about water jets, and he's talking about desktop water jets like the Wazer, which we mentioned a few episodes back, which is this really cool, like a consumer version of a big water jet cutter that you could just literally put on your desk and it would cut away. And he's asked, will they ever be practical for small knife makers to own? And I said, we did talk about this, and I think it was in maybe the second episode, episode 2. But I've got a friend who actually has one of the Wazers. I think they're probably great for prototyping, but when it comes to production, they can be very, very expensive. And even on their website, they have like a price comparison of, you know, using the Wazer to laser cut something out. And it uses so much garnet because it's not that much, the pressure isn't really, really that high. And the way a water jet works is it uses garnet, which is an abrasive, almost like a sand, and it uses a high pressure water to sort of punch its way through the steel, I suppose. But because it's not very powerful, it uses a hell of a lot of garnet. So, I mean, you say you're a knife maker. As an example, a chef knife, which may be sort of 30 centimeters, but maybe 5 centimeters in width, cutting out could take a few hours. And we'll also go through about $60 worth of garnet, and that's for one knife. So, yeah, great for prototyping, but with regards to production, they're not quite there yet. But I personally, I think like everything else, you know, everything sort of dwindles down from these big sort of commercial machines. And I'm sure that, you know, that'll come down in cost and be able to get better pressure. But whether water jet is the way to go, because, you know, high powder lasers are becoming pretty cheap as well. So, yeah, it'll be nice to see what comes to the desktop that's affordable, that can cut sort of quarter inch stainless steels, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would 100% go for a cheap fiber laser over a cheap water jet. Because the amount of upkeep in a water jet is actually quite high. Like the pumps and stuff in there are, yeah, pretty intense pieces of kit, and they're like constantly mechanically working. Whereas like a fiber laser has like very few moving parts.
So. Yeah, and I mean the fiber laser I have got is a 50 watt, and I had lots of questions. People saying, you know, can you cut a knife out with that? I wouldn't even try. You probably could, but it may take 24 hours and generate so much heat that it really wouldn't be worth it. But it does a very good sort of deep etch for logos and sort of artwork on a blade, that kind of thing. And that's a 50 watt. Some of the knife blanks that I have cut out are using a 50,000 watt fiber laser. And these things are huge. They're the size of a large room. So yeah, you know, that sort of thing coming to the desktop, we're probably quite a few years away from that, unfortunately.
Yeah, but like a 1 kilowatt one, that's probably not too far off. We'll see.
Yeah, maybe.
And
yeah,
I know that like a 1 kilowatt CO2 laser can cut quite a bit of stuff, and fiber lasers are more effective. So
yeah,
we'll see.
And they're fun. They're freaking lasers. They're fun.
They'll shoot your eyes out.
Yeah. Was it Austin Powers, isn't it, with the sharks? Richard Patterson asks, again from Instagram, hi guys, I'm just starting to assemble the parts to build my first CNC router. It's going to be based off the print, I think it's Print NC project, and the domain for that is 3design.store/printnc. It's meant to be an easy-to-build yet rigid machine, and it's got 16mm ball screw, linear rails, and a 2.2kW spindle with a handful of 3D-printed parts that can be upgraded to aluminium once your machine is up and running. So his question is regarding the motion control system. He says he's torn between a 32-bit Gerbil setup or Linux CNC. And this one's over to you, Aaron. But as regards to a motion control system, what would you be recommended for that kind of machine?
Well, the problem is we've got split experience here, because you've used Gerbil a lot and I haven't used it. And I've used Linux CNC a lot and you haven't used it. So
yeah, I've only used Gerbil stuff, basically, really basic Gerbil stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Linux CNC is really, really good. I mean, I don't think you're really going to have any problems with Linux CNC. I don't think you're going to hit any limitations, whereas with Gerbil you might. So, I don't know. I think you'd probably be okay either way. I like Linux CNC more personally, I think, because it's kind of like with Gerbil, you have like your controller, and then you have your, you know, G-code sender, like your computer, and then, you know, whereas Linux CNC is like all in one.
Right. Yeah.
That I mean, being
there are sort of Gerbil software out there where you don't have to have a separate sender, and you can do it in one. But yeah, from my understanding of it, it is probably more limited to regards to file sizes specifically, I think, compared to something like, you know, something dedicated like a Linux CNC.
Right. Yeah. With Linux CNC, it's going to be more expensive. You need more stuff. Like, so with Linux CNC, you can just use the parallel port on a computer to generate your step and direction pulses for the drivers. But it's not the best way of doing it, because then all of the pulses are generated in software. And so, you know, if you like open a web browser or something, then it can disrupt the timing of those pulses. So the best way to do a Linux CNC setup is it's called a Mesa Electronics I forget what they call it, Mesa Electronics Stepper card. So it's basically like a PCI Express card that goes into your computer, and that has a, you know, its own little tiny computer in it that actually does the step and direction. And, you know, so they're like, I think they're like $150 US, but then you get like really high step rates, really consistent, and like really nice integration with Linux CNC. But Gerbil kind of gets you the same thing because it has like a dedicated controller for generating the step and direction pulses. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's a six of one, half dozen of the other. I think Linux CNC is more capable, especially when you start talking about like tool changers and so on. But for a machine with no tool changer, I think you're probably okay either way.
Yeah. And I'd say, I mean, Richard's probably used to using one of these anyway, because he's actually building his first router. So you got to assume he's got some sort of experience of using that, using some sort of CNC machine anyway. So maybe go with what you're used to. You know, if it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, go with what you're used to, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, Linux CNC is going to grow more with you, but it's also a much more complicated setup. Like, so
yeah,
I agree with Craig on this one.
Ooh.
First time ever.
Ben Siegel asks, how many knives, and this is specifically for Aaron, how many knives can you make at once with your CNC setup? I watched a couple of your YouTube videos the other night and just assumed you had a massive 4x8 setup.
Oh, interesting. But if he's seen the videos, he's seen the fixtures. Ben.
Yeah.
What?
He must have started at the beginning and he's working his way. Date order.
No, so, I mean, the answer is one. How many knives can I make? The answer is one. So, basically, my fixtures are arranged from left to right in a number of different stations. So, station one, I'm taking a rectangle of steel and I'm machining the inside, like the weight reduction in the tang. And then I'm doing the pinholes, which are my locating features. And then station two is cutting the spine of the knife. So I'm holding onto it with a clamp that comes down from the top, locating it via the pinholes, and then cutting the spine. Station three is the same for the edge. Station four is doing one side of the bevels. Station five is doing the other side of the bevels, and then station six is doing the handle scales. But all of that happens in one cycle, and at the end I get one knife. So yeah, it's actually a good way of doing it, because then you're not like, if you're machining like five knives at a time and, you know, you have some problem in your program or a tool is worn out or something, then you're gonna have five knives that are wrong. You know? Yeah. So I like the one at a time process.
I think anybody else answering that question would say, I'd load up the machine as many as I can fit in. But Aaron's not like anybody else. And if you've seen the more recent videos, you'd certainly see that accuracy is everything. So yeah, as Aaron just described it, is process there. It blows my mind seeing the videos of the way things are done. And it's not how I'd imagine them being done. So make sure you go and have a look at those videos, because, yeah, they will completely blow your mind, especially the more recent ones.
I've got some more videos coming soon too, particularly on fixturing.
Oh, we've heard video. You say that before.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun, actually. I've been, you know, more productive, as I said, and doing more video editing. So cool. I finished the video on making a new knife making fixture the other day. And I'm about halfway through doing a video showing how I went through the process of accurizing my fixture, making it more accurate.
Yes, I did see an Instagram post about that. So it's Goff Customs on YouTube, you are, isn't it?
Yes.
It is.
Just Goff Customs. Yeah.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you were saying like, oh, you wouldn't imagine that it's made this way. I mean, so the way that I manufacture my knives is called single piece flow. That's my ideal, is to do everything one at a time, and then every step flows through one knife. And that's actually like a legit manufacturing concept, because it, as I said, like when you have one piece going through all the time, you're exercising every part of your process all the time, and you're also able to very quickly make changes. You know, oh, this thing isn't working, so you make a change, and then every every part after that is the new process.
Yes, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Batchwork, yeah. So like lots of like auto manufacturing parts, plants and stuff use single piece flow whenever they can.
Hmm. And I suppose I do that in a very sort of manual way. So, for example, with my knives, I generally work in batches. But particularly if it's a new model, what I'll do, I'll take a small handful of knives and go from the very beginning process to the very end process, singularly on each knife, rather than do the whole batch, because in just the way you described, if there's a fault on one, they'd all have that fault. So I'll make sure that one is completely nailed. Then I'll repeat that process over and over then within the batch.
Yeah, and I'm very much working toward the idea of having everything be single piece flow, no batch work at all. So like, right. I want to bring coating in house. I want to do the DLC coating or an equivalent in my shop, so that way I can just coat one knife at a time. So comes off the machine, I do all the hand finishing, I tumble, I do blasting, it goes in for coating, and then I do the next one. So yeah, we'll see. Long term goals.
JF Gunworks asks, what limitations have you run into with the old Fidal control? So for those who haven't seen, Aaron's got these two big sort of Fidal machines, VMCs. Are they the same model?
No, not quite. But
right.
So one's a VMC 10 and one's a VMC 15. And the VMC 10 is actually a very rare beast. But it's basically just a VMC 15 with a slightly smaller spindle motor and no enclosure. That's the only difference.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's asking about the control of these Fidals, and he's saying, can you run long programs that are a large file size? Because these are pretty old machines, aren't they? Are they 80s, 90s?
1993 and 1997.
Okay.
Yeah. So old. Pretty
general. So I think that's the sort of basis of the question, really. Can you run long programs that are a large file size on those?
Yeah. So interestingly, for machines of this vintage, they actually had quite a lot of memory. So even the machine with the smallest memory has 140 kilobytes, which doesn't sound like very much now, but in terms of like a G-code program, that's actually a fair bit. And you can actually upgrade them. I think it's like $600 or $700 for an upgrade card that takes them up to 4 megabytes. Four whole megabytes. but you don't have to do that. The other way, they actually have a serial interface as well, and you can drip feed them programs. So basically, you start loading a program into the machine, and then you give it a chunk of data, and then once it's run that chunk of data, it says, give me more, and you give it more data. So I actually have a box called a DNC box, it's basically a drip feeding box that drip feeds data to the control over serial. And those boxes come from a company in the States called CalMotion. And basically that lets you run files of unlimited size. Like I could run a 4 gigabyte G-code file if I wanted to.
So that's like a buffer zone then. So it'll take all the data and just slowly drip it into something that can handle far less. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like the standard program that I run on my fixture setup is 20 meg. And that's no problem at all. Mm. So yeah, it's interesting. Like some controls from that vintage are really, really limited. They had, 1 kilobyte of memory and no way to drip feed, and that's it. So like, best of luck, but it just happens that the Fidal controls accidentally were very future proof.
I always wonder when I see these old machines, because they have this big sort of Star Trek console with them, with these like mechanical keyboard buttons on them, and there's all these buttons, I'm thinking, well, what would they be used for? Because you're certainly not like inputting G-code manually in on one of those, surely. And I was thinking, If you have, like with yours, you said you've got a serial interface. Surely everything's done sort of off that. So,
but it didn't used to be. You have to remember we've got Fusion and stuff. We've got CAM programs now, but in the 90s, they had CAM programs, but they also had Finger CAM, where you typed this shit out yourself. You'd sit there and look at a part and write the G code by hand. And and you know, back in the day, there was a big emphasis on machines being like heavy and rigid and strong. And that's because, you know, when you were roughing at a part, you would just like take one cut around the outside, you know, because you're hand programming this stuff. You don't want to have to do like trochoidal milling. You don't want to have to do like adaptive roughing where you're making like 1,000 passes. You wanted to make one.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, there was definitely a period of time where you wrote a lot of G-code by hand, you know? And the Fidal control is set up to do that. Like, you can edit a program by hand. You can kind of preview, kind of, in pixels. You can see some pixels of showing you what it will kind of do, you know? Yeah, it was a different time. And yeah, whereas now, it's like, if I'm editing a program on the control, like, that's very unusual.
Yeah. So you're literally just bypassing that whole sort of console then and just feeding it via the serial port from your laptop, wherever it may be. Right, okay.
Kind of, yeah. Well, so the CalMotion box is actually integrated into the control. So, like, I have, like, a USB port on the side of the control. And then you talk to that box via the control itself. So you say, you type in from the little command line that's on the thing, you say CD, 10, which means talk over the serial connection at a particular baud rate, like a particular data rate. And then anything you type after that actually gets sent straight to the CalMotion box. So then you can say DNC for like drip feed, comma, and then your file name. And you hit enter, and then it starts drip feeding to the control. So it's actually pretty well integrated, which is nice.
Yeah, wow. That's... Yeah, I've always just imagined those big consoles. I just couldn't imagine what they were being used for. But that would make sense. Yeah, before people had laptops and higher-end machines, they would have been, manually entering almost like keyframes for the G-code, which is crazy.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is, too, like, you know, so I know you've mainly used Gerbil and you've never had, like, a jog wheel, right? But, like, my machine has a jog wheel, so I can put it in jog mode, and then I can select X, Y, or Z axis, and I can select what increment I want to jog in, like 10,000ths at a time, 1,000th, or 1/10,000th. Yes, and then I can spin a little dial and move the machine. And it feels very like it's like a mechanical connection. It feels like you're, you know, like moving a manual milling machine. And, yeah, because you've never experienced that, you don't know what you're missing. It's really...
Yeah, well, I mean, I can jog with, you know, the machines that I have here, and you know,
with a frigging keyboard.
Cursor keys on a keyboard, yeah. There's no rotary action, I suppose.
Yeah, so I've done that too, because I've used Linux CNC and so on. But, like, yeah, don't worry, Craig. You don't know what you're missing. Like, for doing a setup, I mean, it's less of an issue for you, because you're normally, like, putting a sheet of material in, bolting it down to the spoil board and then cutting it, right? So it doesn't really matter exactly where that sheet is, really, except in Z.
Yeah.
Z. But for me,
Let's stick with the Z.
Uh-huh. You know, you're chucking a part in the vise and you have to locate it to like 1/10,000th of an inch in all three axes before you start machining it. So like doing that with a keyboard, you're going to be sitting there like tap, 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 tap. You know, like it's going to be stupid. Whereas with the jog wheel, you can just... You know, I don't even look at the control when I'm doing it. I'm just, you know, I know where the three little things are, like you're changing for the axis, changing for the step size, and then the jog wheel, and you just go for it. Like, it just feels really, really natural.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you've got some sort of XYZ probe on yours, so each time you put your fixtures in, that is, they're always in the right place.
Yeah, so I actually do it two different ways. Like, if I'm prototyping something, then, yeah, I use what's called a Hamer 3D Taster. It's a very funny name, but it's basically like a dial indicator that works in all three dimensions.
Hmm.
So you can... It has a probe on it, and when that probe deflects by half of its diameter, so then it reads as zero. So you don't have to, like, offset by the size of your probe tip, which is something you normally have to do with an edge finder, for instance. You can just like jog it up against the side of the material until it reads zero, and then you enter zero in the control. And that thing is so nice. Like, they're not super cheap. I think they're like $500 or $600 US, but they're just amazing. I cannot imagine being without it. And then for the fixtures themselves, like my production fixtures, doing that every time, like having to take it off, put it back on, measure where it is, it's bullshit. You don't want to have to do that. So I actually bored holes into the table of my machine for dowel pins. And then the fixtures all have dowel pins on the bottoms of them. And so I can take it off and put it back on, and it's in exactly the same place as it was.
Very clever. Well, the Onefinity machine, which I've ordered, has like an edge finder with sort of XYZ probe, I suppose. But I'm wondering, I don't know how they work yet, so I can't wait for this to come so I can see. But I'd imagine that it would be looking for a change of current when it hits something. So yeah, if it was a
conductive
if
sensor.
It was a piece of steel, for example, that would work. But obviously, using G10, it probably won't work. So I'm just wondering whether there would be a solution for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of ways you could do it, but probably the cheapest and easiest way is like you get an alligator clip and a piece of like steel shim stock, and you put the little bit of steel shim stock on your material, and then use the alligator clip to make sure that it's connected to the ground, and then touch off that way.
And that's a set height, and then you use that as an offset. Then I've got
Or you could use like a little steel block, or you know, whatever. That's probably what you're meant to do, I would imagine. Yeah. And you can probably do that with the tools themselves too, right? To set your tool heights.
Yeah, makes sense.
I mean, that system works pretty well.
Cool.
So, like, yeah, I actually use a variant of that system for setting up my tool heights on the Fidal. I have what's called a conductive tool setter, which is literally like, it's like two plates joined by an LED and a battery. And when you know, it has the top and the bottom. And when you make a circuit in between the top and the bottom, it lights up. And it uses the whole machine frame to complete the circuit. So you put it on the table, then you have your tool in the spindle, and when you touch the tool to the top of it, you make the circuit between the table and the spindle, and then it lights up.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Works great.
So as an update, I still don't have a a large scale. I say large scale. It'll be large scale for me compared to what I'm currently using, sort of CNC machines. But it is on its way.
That's exciting. Yeah,
but it's, you know, every time there's a knock on the door, I'm thinking that could be. I know it's not, but I've got weeks to go before it arrives. But I'm just thinking it could be. But no, unfortunately not. So I'm looking through our notes here, and you made a little note here saying 3D printing for production, is it just too slow? Mm-hmm. So I thought that might be something interesting for us to talk about, because we've already mentioned 3D printing quite a bit in this show, and it's got a bit of a 3D printing focus, I suppose, for production. So, I mean, well, we've talked about filament, various filaments, and you know, the pluses and minuses of whether it's PLA, ABS, and all that kind of thing. Have you used any of the 3D printers where you use the resin? I'm trying to think what they're called.
No. SLA printers.
That's it.
Stereolithography. Yeah, so the idea with those is, I mean, you probably know, but for the broader audience is, you have a little bath of resin, and then you have like a platform that goes into the bath of resin, and then from the bottom, you shine a UV laser or a UV LED, which cures the resin in one little spot. And then you do that to make a whole layer, and then you move the platform up and you just keep adding to it. And no, I haven't used one, and I don't really want to, because the resins tend to be kind of nasty. It's like having a pool of epoxy in your shop all the time, and then you have to handle the resins, and you know, yeah, they're not. If you have like a way of, basically, I would want a fume hood. Like, I would want to be constantly evacuating the air around one of those machines to outside.
I mean, I do find that even sometimes with, you know, a normal sort of three-axis, you know, with a nozzle printer, that sometimes the fumes can get quite strong if you're using it in a, you know, confined space. Sometimes I think.
And do you just find that with PLA? Like, what materials are you printing?
But I've only got PLA here at the moment. So yeah, and I think it's just maybe just the heat is generating something. But I've got this like little extractor porter which I use with my fiber laser because that kicks out some horrible fumes. So I think I'm going to make just a little Y, a Y splitter. And have it going up to a 3D printer as well, because moving into the new shop, which I'll be doing in the next few months, I've got this idea of a dirty side and a clean side. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite fortunate. I'm getting to sort of make this from the ground up, this whole new shop. So what I want is a glass sort of... It's very futuristic. I've sort of designed it in my head. So it's split 50-50. It's a big sort of rectangular shape, split 50-50 with basically just a glass wall between the two, and obviously right. A door between the two then. And the dark side is all going to be black. Literally the dark side. And in there will be grinders, anything that kicks up fumes, anything that would produce dirt, mess, fumes, anything, is all going to be that side. And then the white side, which is going to be crisp white, Apple Store white, brand spanking new shiny stuff, is going to be completely clean. So I'm thinking I may need some sort of buffer zone between the two.
Like an airlock? Probably... Go in there and big blasts of air clean you down.
Just...
Yeah, exactly.
That would be pretty cool. But no, just I'm not just walking crap through that kind of thing, so right. I'll make some sort of, let's say, a buffer zone. I want the anything with fumes or dirt to be over on that dark side. And for that dark side to have really good extraction, so particulate extraction as well, just in the air, cleaning, scrubbing the air at all points, and each machine to have its own extractor point as well, whether that's for dust or whatever it may be.
And where do you think the 3D printer is going?
Well, that's the question. I've noticed just recently, just printing off these little parts, the GoPro bits and pieces that I've been doing. And I've been making these little jigs as well for grinding knives, funnily enough, right. For the 3D printer. And they do work quite well. They've been kicking out this fumes. So I'm thinking maybe they need to go in the dirty side.
Wrong.
Yeah, that's...
Incorrect answer, Craig. Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that to your printer.
I mean, that's the thing. They've got all these sort of exposed electronics on them, and going anywhere near a grinder, which obviously I'm grinding a lot of metal. There's iron filings everywhere, so it probably isn't the right place. But maybe that needs to be in the buffer zone. Maybe I have a third room, which is dirty, not that dirty. And surgically clean. Maybe,
you could have
maybe
a gradient
a
of rooms. You could have 255 stages of rooms. Yeah. Each one more dirty than the last. No, I would say don't do extraction, because the problem is if you decide you want to start printing with like ASA, which I think you probably should, given your use cases, or PETG, then like the airflow from the extractor is going to cause all your prints to warp.
Yes, true. Yeah.
So I would personally, if I was you, I would just build a box around your printer. Just build like an airtight enclosure, and just close it. Done. Problem solved.
Yeah, and that's particularly helpful with things like ABS anyway, because you need that sort of temperature to be very stable. So that would help that way too.
Yeah, and then you don't really have the fumes because they're in a box.
Yeah. So they're on the clean. They've made it to the clean side.
There you go. Done. What's your next problem, Craig? let's knock them all down. Well, one thing I did want to... So I want to go back to 3D printing in a second, but I got an Instagram message from JF Gunworks. So we were talking about the Fidal control, and that was his question. But he sent me a video of his Grizzly G0704 CNC conversion. So this is a little tiny milling machine that's been converted to CNC.
Yeah, and it was cutting... I think we talked about the week before last, didn't we?
I was kind of shit-canning them. I was like, I don't think they're ever going to be that great. And he sent me a video that blew my mind. It's just his little machine. So I have a joke with my girlfriend. Like, whenever I'm talking about a machine, I'm like, oh, that machine's got the Burt.
Burt.
Yeah, so it comes from Do you know the plane, the A-10 Warthog?
No, no.
Okay, so the A-10 Warthog is the America's tank killer from like the 80s. It was basically a plane built around a gun.
Okay.
So it was built around
with
the
wings.
Yes, it is literally a gun with wings. Like at one point, the gun's recoil produces about 50% of the force as the engines do.
Wow.
Like it is a huge gun. It is literally a plane built around a gun. But yeah, there's a joke with that plane that it's got the burt burt because that's the noise that it makes. Burt burt when it's shooting. Okay. And a good milling machine should make that same noise when it's roughing materials. It just goes brrr, you know, chews through the material. There's no high pitch noise. And JF Gunworks' little GO704 mill was cutting aluminum, and it was just rumbling. Brrr, perfect.
It's got the burt burt.
It's got the burt burt. So like, I was super impressed with that little machine. So he did send me some videos. I'm going to post them on our Instagram. I just have to make sure that that's okay with him, but like, yeah, it sounded great. I was super impressed. So, you know, maybe that's more of an option than you think. Aluminum in that case,
right?
Which is definitely easier than steel. But he was taking a pretty aggressive cut. He was taking, I think it was like 3/8 of an inch deep with a 1/4 inch end mill, straight through and like a slotting. So like,
wow,
full width of cut.
Yeah.
It sounded great.
Maybe we can get him to do some hard milling for us. He can be our tester. He can test this machine for us.
That would be fun, actually.
Please don't break your machine on our behalf.
You can break it on my behalf, that's fine. Yeah, I would happily send him some tools and some steel if he wants to do it. So, JF Gunworks, you know where I'm at. Maybe we need to do a hard milling challenge.
That sort of takes us on a bit to what we talked about last week. So we had our guest last week, and at the top of the show we mentioned this, and we're going to get him back on. So all the questions that we asked, we will actually edit into one show. But we did go into that a fair bit, didn't we, into sort of hard milling on a smaller machine.
Yeah, and he was a bit horrified when I said if I had one of those machines, I would try it. He was like, oh.
Yes, yeah. But what we have an opportunity now, at least. So, we fucked up last week. I fucked up last week. But we do now have an opportunity. So if anybody has questions for Bree, send them through to us, because he's got such this great past of being a maker. As I say, he founded MakerBot, and for me, they were the company that really brought sort of 3D printers to the desktop. Certainly got me into 3D printing, you know, all those years ago. And you know, he's influential with regards to, you know, home makers. And I think that's the goal, really, with the Bantam Toolworks CNC as well, to make what would normally be, you know, prototyping it in a factory, making it accessible to people at home.
Yeah.
And obviously he's got a background then with, you know, Thingiverse, which, you know, the library of 3D print files, and he wrote for Make magazine. So he's got this really varied past. So I'm sure lots of you have questions for him. So if you have, send them through, and we can put them to Bree when we do get a chance to re-record too.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, the little machine's super cool. I would love to try hard milling on one. I mean, maybe that's just too evil, but like, I definitely want to try it.
Try it till it breaks. Is that what you're trying to say? See what the breaking point is.
Yeah, I guess so. If I break it, I've bought it, you know.
That's true. So you wanted to mention something about 3D printing before we left, before we finished the show.
No, I don't think so. That was the JF Gunworks thing that I wanted to mention. The 3D printing.
Well, I've got you.
Is it too slow for production? I mean, so like Prusa, the guys that made your little printer, they don't agree with me because like all of those parts are printed on their printers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it now, and it's basically 3D printed. There's some aluminium extrusion for the Z axis, but virtually everything else is 3D printed apart from the bed.
And their print farms are pretty crazy. They have like thousands and thousands of their own printers printing 24 hours a day.
Have you seen that video where it's like 9 stories, this building? Have you seen the video on YouTube? It's incredible.
Yeah, if you go on YouTube and watch like the Prusa factory tour, it's very, very cool. I actually want to go to Prague now just so I can go
hello,
you know? Yeah, very, very cool. And like, it's honestly like they're eating their own dog food. is what we would call it. Yeah. You know, they're using their own printers way harder than anybody else is ever going to, basically.
Yeah. And so, I think I've said before, this isn't the third printer that I've had. So I had one of the original MakerBots, and then I had a Sapphire Pro, which I've still got here. But any other printer I've used have just been so finicky. You could never run it sort of 24 hours a day because you're always fixing something on it. They're a project. You always have something. But with this Prusa, it's just incredible. You turn it on and it does its own sort of, it's got like a Z probe. So it'll work out, you know, the distance to the bed. Once you've done that once, it's all set up, ready to go. I've never had to make an adjustment. And I can just turn it on, and I know it'll just print perfectly every time. That would be a great guest to have Joseph Prusa on the show. Maybe we could work on that.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Well, and is yours the Mini or the Mini Plus?
It's the Mini Plus. It was the Mini that I think I ordered, and during that time, because there's still quite a wait, I still think it's about 5-6 weeks at least, actually, before delivery. And during that time, they'd upgraded to the Mini Plus.
Yeah, and the Mini Plus. So the Mini Plus has a different height sensor on it
for sensing the bed,
and it's supposed to be a lot better than. They tried to like do a less expensive one to keep the price down, and it just didn't work as they wanted. But yeah, I'm still like, you know, I've looked at so many 3D printers over the last little while, you know, and so I have a friend that he literally tests 3D printers and 3D printing filament for his job. So I have a question, I send him an email, and he, you know, I said, okay, if you could have one printer, what would you buy? And he was like, a Raise 3D Pro. And so that's like a $3,500 FDM printer, right? Like, it's not cheap, but it'll print anything, you know, carbon fiber, whatever you want to print it. But even looking at the prints off that machine, I'm still tempted by the Prusa Mini because it's just, you know, as you said, it just works.
Yeah.
They just seem, and I think like, it's like bulletproof.
$300. It's not particularly expensive.
I think they're $400 US. It works out to like 700 Canadian.
The build volume isn't the biggest, but I've never printed anything that would be over sort of 7-inch cubit anyway. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's more than big enough for anything I need.
Yeah.
That's what she said. I'm on the wrong show. I'm
in the
mindset of doing a different show there.
Yeah. Should we talk about our testicles before we go? I think that if you just have one printer, then printing for production is hard. Yeah. But like the approach seems to be, well, that's fine. They're little and they don't use much power, so just get 10 of them.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And don't worry about the electricity consumption until later, till the bill comes.
Well, they don't use that much power, honestly. Like, my CNC machine sitting there doing nothing consume a kilowatt.
Do you know what uses the most power with my 3D printer here? So when I first got it, it wouldn't do anything. And I was like, oh, I've been sent to dead. And basically, it needs a minimum temperature. But the error message on the screen doesn't tell you that. It just says, like, you know, a generic error. And I was like, oh, well, what's this? But you need to be, I think it's 18 degrees C before it'll even start up. And that's something that could change in the firmware. Just change that that error message so people would understand. But me being silly and me wanted it to work immediately and not having to wait around, I was like, oh, it's broken. Anyway, so I contacted them. I said, no, it needs. Siri's going to be crazy. But no, they said it needs to be over 18 degrees. So because my shop is so cold this time of the year, I'm probably using more electricity to heat up the area that the printer is in that the printer actually uses. But, you know, that wouldn't be a problem in the summer, obviously.
Well, there you go. I've got another suggestion for you then. Chuck it in your enclosure and then use like a hydroponic grow mat or like a seedling grow mat underneath it, right? And just keep the enclosure warm.
I'll be on a list. If I start ordering stuff like that online, I'll be on one of those lists that you're on.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. I'm on worse lists than that. Yeah.
And on that bombshell, I think that's a show.
I think so.
I think so. So remember, if you've got questions for Bree, send them through to us on Instagram. We are xyz.cnc on Instagram. And again, any sort of CNC-related questions you have or machining questions, send them through. I won't have a clue what you're talking about, but maybe Aaron can help. All this time, people are wondering, well, why are you doing a show about CNC? And it's a case of sort of osmosis for me, putting myself in an environment where other people are asking questions and Aaron's using, you know, his wealth of information to help. I'm slowly taking that in. And that is basically how I got into knife making. So as a knife maker, I was just, you know, happily doing my own thing. And then I started Knife Talk, which is another podcast that I do. And thankfully, Aaron was one of the, I think you were the third guest on that show, or second or third guest. And that's since gone on to do, you know, a few hundred episodes. But the knowledge that I got from doing the show by speaking to, you know, far smarter people than me has been a big help. So that's the purpose of me doing this show. So, yeah, to gain as much knowledge as I can from not just Aaron, who knows virtually everything, but you listeners as well. So if you've got any questions, send them in, because it all helps to sort of feed my knowledge bucket as well.
Well, you're learning. Now when you look at a big machine cutting something, you'll go, burt, burt.
Burt, burt. And those buttons, they actually do something as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Today. That's the show. Thank you all very much for listening, and I wish to speak to you again next week.
Bye, guys.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.